Who's hiring?
And who's firing?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, May 3rd.
Coming up, economic talks in China take a backseat to diplomatic drama.
Starbucks gets into the money lending business.
And reducing stress for people who can't even spell the word stress yet.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Tomorrow, we'll get the most important economic indicator of the month, the April jobs report from the Labor Department. It'll tell us how many jobs were created last month, if any, and what the new unemployment rate is.
And one thing we do know this morning is that if tomorrow's report is bad, it'll be mainly due to a lack of hiring rather than a surge in layoffs. The job placement firm Challenger Gray & Christmas says planned layoffs were basically flat last month. CEO John Challenger joins us now from Chicago with more on this. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So what are your numbers telling you, John, about layoffs that are planned and about the job market in general?
We saw just over 40,000 cuts in the month of April. That was up 7% from what we saw the month before, but 11% from April a year ago. So the cuts seem to be slowly growing in line with this very slow growth economy. If we don't see a pickup in the economy, more growth, it will be tough for job creation to grow to the levels we need to see unemployment drop.
And I saw in your report that a lot of the planned layoffs are in the education sector.
Education was hard hit in the month. School districts continue to be under pressure to cut costs amid the massive state and local budget deficits. Over 9,000 cuts announced in that area.
What do you think about the recent slowdown we've seen in job creation recently? What do you think is causing that, and will it continue?
Well, we'll see. It happened for the first time after six strong months of job creation last month. The high price of gasoline certainly is affecting the transportation sector, goods getting across the country, back and forth across the country, and that could be the real issue there.
John Challenger, CEO of Challenger Gray & Christmas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, while we're talking jobs, here's another little something we know already. The number of people unemployed long-term remains at record levels. Marketplace's John Dimsdale takes a closer look.
In the first 3 months of this year, 3.9 million Americans had been out of work for a year or more. That's only a slight improvement from 2011. And the latest update from the Pew Fiscal Analysis Initiative finds long-term unemployment for older workers is getting worse. Ingrid Schroeder is the initiative's director.
Workers age 55 and older, although they're less likely to lose their job in the first place, they're more likely to stay unemployed for a longer period of time than all the other age groups.
She says employers figure elderly people lose their job skills more quickly. In Orlando, Florida, 59-year-old Fred Sanford has heard that before. He lost his job with Merrill Lynch nearly 2 years ago. He says prospective employers have an age bias.
I've got tons of experience and documentation, but I think there's to the point where they can hire a kid out of college for half of what they think they could hire me for.
At the AARP Public Policy Institute, Sarah Rick says the longer someone's out of work, the harder it is to find a job for everybody.
Employers wonder what is wrong with this worker if he or she hasn't been able to find a job in 6 months.
Rick's recommends unemployed workers take advantage of retraining programs to show they're keeping job skills current. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Now we come to CEO pay. The research firm GMI Ratings found that CEO pay is on the rise again. The compensation for running a company rose an average 15% last year and 28% the year before that. The average CEO pay in the U.S. is nearly $6 million for a year's work. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Herbalife's Michael Johnson is the highest-paid CEO in the country, raking in $89 million in cash and stock in 2011. IBM's Sam Palmisano and Edward Breen of Tyco each made about $63 million. I asked Lucy Marcus, who advises the boards of directors of companies, whether one person's labor can ever really be worth $89 million.
Well, intuitively, I suppose one thinks not.
So why so much money? Is this some kind of CEO payday arms race?
Everyone is judged by how much everyone else is making.
That's Charles Elson, a finance professor at the University of Delaware. But what's wrong with getting rich while running a company? Shouldn't executives reap the rewards if their companies succeed? Elson says there's a flaw in that logic.
The process itself is basically unrelated to performance.
Both Marcus and Elson agree that part of the problem is that boards of directors, who have the final word on pay packages, are disconnected from reality. That problem won't be solved anytime soon. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Starbucks, the coffee company, is getting into the money lending business. And before you run out thinking you can combine a grande latte plus low-interest business loan in one stop, let me explain. Starbucks is working with one of the pioneers of microlending in developing countries, the Grameen Foundation, to lend money to small coffee farmers. Microloans are typically micro in size and shorter term. The loans to which Starbucks is contributing a portion are longer term. A group in Germany that works to get better deals for producers in poor countries, Fair Trade International, is also part of this. As our midday extra today, I spoke with Ben Packard, Vice President of Global Responsibility at Starbucks. Mr. Packard, good morning.
Good morning, David. A pleasure to be here.
You hear about microfinance in many parts of the developing world. What you're thinking of is something that's a little bit longer term, this financing.
Yes, our latest investment of €1 million in a fund with the Grameen Foundation and IncoFin is a dedicated fund to fair trade producers. These are small producers that are typically looking for longer term financing to help improve the resilience of their own farms, be they investments in the age of their trees, the coffee plants, be it investments in the infrastructure needed to produce high-quality coffee.
€1 million is about $1.3 million. So at the ground level, what you're saying is a coffee producer could be able to borrow money that they might not normally be able to borrow.
That's exactly right. Typically, the producers will organize into cooperatives, and together that cooperative may go after increased access to funding. Typically, that has been in the form of short-term loans, but this fund is going to focus on increasing capacity by investing in infrastructure, be it wet mills or dry mills or drying equipment that's going to help improve the quality and the yield and therefore the income of these small farmer communities.
Now, if this works, it is, of course, potentially useful for the farmers in question. There's a human angle here, but what's in it for Starbucks?
Well, our success is best when it's shared, and that's a long-term approach that Starbucks takes. It's part of the way we're doing business.
And where you get your coffee is part of that.
Yes. The resilience of our supply chain, we absolutely believe, is fundamental to the Starbucks business success. And increasing capacity and quality in these coffee-growing communities is one really important aspect of that.
So not short-term, longer-term, like what are you talking about for the payback period? Any idea?
Well, the payback to the farmers has typically been in the, you know, the harvest loan, so less than a year. But this fund in particular is going to stretch into the 2 to 4 year period.
So 2 to 4 years as opposed to just the cycle of one planting.
Exactly.
Well, Ben Packard, VP for Global Responsibility at Starbucks, thank you very much for this.
Thanks, David. My pleasure.
The Coffee Farmer Loan Program will start first in Latin America with plans to expand to Africa and Asia.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Bill Clinton is warning Europeans that the prescription of austerity, quote, continues to be pushed in the face of evidence that it won't work. Speaking at the Milken Institute Global Conference in California, the former president said what's needed in Europe and the U.S. is less political rancor and more long-term thinking on promoting growth. Now, for those not inclined to accept this kind of economic advice from an ex-U.S. president, the question arises, who do Americans trust to handle these matters? Which brings us to our weekly Attitude Check, a partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll number suggests margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Joining us is Gallup's editor-in-chief, Frank Newport. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
All right, then. So who do Americans say they trust to handle our economic problems? I mean, I could come up with a list. It might have Bernanke on it, the Fed chair.
Well, indeed, we did come up with a list. We read it to Americans. We do that every April and said, how much confidence do you have in each of the following to recommend the right thing in the economy? And in answer to your question, I would say none of the above. Obama comes out better than anybody else, but only 19% of Americans say they have a great deal of confidence in what the president would recommend on the economy. Romney, we tested him a little behind that, and then you mentioned Fed Chair Bernanke. He's a little below that. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is still lower, and then the Democratic and Republican leaders in Congress are lower still. So when you look at it from a big picture, Americans don't have confidence in a lot of these people, and probably that's because even though economic confidence is up, a lot of Americans still rate the current economy is not good. And since most of these people are in charge, they're saying, why should I trust these people? So far, they're not doing a great job.
Did you say economic confidence is up?
That's right. Consumer confidence, economic confidence is certainly a lot better now in our Gallup tracking than it was last year. So we do have a more positive American population, but on an absolute basis, it's still in negative territory. So on a relative basis, Americans are more positive. On an absolute basis, they're nowhere near where they were, let's say, back in the 2000s.
On a program like this, names like Bernanke and Geithner are sort of in our top panoply of stars. But I know that if I go down on the street here in New York after we talk and ask people, who is the Treasury Secretary of the United States of America? We're going to have some blank stares.
Well, it depends on what street you go down, right? If you go down Wall Street, you probably have more people that would know.
Fair
than
point,
in Main
Frank.
Street America. That's right. But let me say that 85% of Americans, David, give an opinion on Bernanke. Now, whether or not they know exactly what it is that he does, we don't know. But that's up. When we first tested the Fed chair, Bernanke, back in 2006, only about 60% plus were able to give an opinion, and now we have 85%. So whether they know exactly what it is he does, whether they could name him spontaneously when we read his name, and also when we read Geithner's name, you know, over 8 out of 10 Americans are willing to give an opinion. And as I mentioned before, the opinion is not overwhelmingly positive about how smart these guys are on the economy.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at Gallup, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Well, now to China, where U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are today. They're supposed to be talking about issues like trade, but instead, everyone is focused on a blind Chinese dissident named Chen Guangcheng, who took refuge at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and is now asking for asylum in the United States. Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now from Shanghai with more on this. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Jeremy.
So how is this going to affect these high-level talks between the U.S. and China that are going on today?
Well, you know, it certainly managed to steal much of the media's attention. You know, this year, like previous ones, the focus of these talks from the U.S. side, at least, is on things like China's currency and securing intellectual property rights for U.S. companies in China. But now we've got this very interesting and fast-moving drama that's forcing both sides to really take a stand that neither of them really want to take. I spoke with James McGregor today. He's a senior counselor at APCO Worldwide, and he's been briefing U.S. officials in preparation for this week's summit. He told me he thought the Chen episode threatens to overshadow the talks this week in Beijing.
You have to remember, these talks are a lot of theatrics because you've got 200 officials on each side kind of giving set-piece speeches and, you know, scratching around for a deliverable or two so they can put out a press release at the end.
But, Jeremy, I don't think anybody's expecting a press release at the end of this week about human rights or Chen Guangcheng.
And, Rob, of course, this situation comes right after the Bo Xilai case about this Chinese official who had sort of fallen out of favor with the top leadership in Beijing. Then his wife gets accused of murdering a British businessman. It seems like a lot of uncomfortable stuff going on for the top leadership in China.
That's right. And at a year when the leadership in Beijing is changing over to a completely new leadership, I think we're all waiting to see how this year could possibly get even crazier.
Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz joining us from Shanghai. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A very young entrepreneur from Connecticut is starting a business with a potential market the size of the population of Earth. 13-year-old Mallory Keevman went to one of those business startup competitions where you pitch your big idea and won. Her idea, special lollipops that she says help with that nearly universal human scourge, hiccups. The New York Times says her patent is now pending, and a bunch of University of Connecticut MBA students this summer are going to help Mallory devise a plan to get hiccup pops on the market.
Well, to Japan now, and the millions of tons of debris floating across the Pacific after last year's tsunami. Some of it has started to arrive in Hawaii and on the U.S. West Coast. And as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports, that means somebody is going to have to pay to clean it up.
It's hard to say exactly how much debris, from soccer balls to fishing boats, will land on U.S. beaches. And because of that, it's hard to put a price tag on the cleanup. But U.S. Senator Mark Begich from Alaska guesses it's not going to be cheap.
It will easily be in the millions to clean this up.
And it's not really clear who is going to pay.
It's going to be a combination of federal government, state governments, local governments to some extent, nonprofit groups, and private sector, because it's not going to be able to be done by one single entity.
NOAA spokesperson Diana Parker says a big part of the cleanup responsibility will fall to do-gooders.
For smaller debris like consumer plastics or styrofoam, we're going to rely pretty heavily on existing volunteer groups that have already formed to deal with marine debris.
Senator Begich says there's no way volunteer help will be enough. He's holding a Senate hearing on tsunami debris in the next couple of weeks. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
This election year, you're going to hear a lot about government regulations, whether they're too tough, not tough enough. Well, at the state level, just the argument over regulation is causing trouble, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Bob Burnley worked for more than 30 years as a state regulator in Virginia. At one point, he headed Virginia's Department of Environmental Quality. He noticed toward the end of his career,
well, the number of reports that we had to do increased all of the time.
Burnley had to do lots of cost-benefit analyses, and then the Virginia legislature established a panel to review regulations.
And those members of the state legislature had the authority to call before them anybody that was making a new rule and make them justify it.
Virginia is not unique. New Jersey regulators now have to file jobs impact statements, quantifying the number of jobs that would be lost or gained because of a proposed rule. The Tennessee legislature formed a task force to root out regulations that it thinks impede job growth. And in Florida, new rules deemed to cost businesses more than $200,000 a year must go back to the legislature for approval. Stuart Shapiro teaches politics and regulation at Rutgers. He says almost every state is doing some kind of regulatory reform, a trend that snowballed over the past 10 years.
In 2010, 136 bills were introduced in state legislatures that required cost-benefit analysis of something. And that's a tremendous number. I mean, there are only 50 states.
Shapiro says you do need some analysis of new rules, but he says the process has become too politicized, with legislators putting up roadblocks to regulation to win support from voters or business owners who don't like government oversight. Jason Schwartz is legal director at NYU's Institute for Policy Integrity.
Unfortunately, the trend across the country is towards adding more levels of regulatory review that aren't particularly helpful.
Especially when, according to Schwartz, states regulate almost 20% of the U.S. economy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, life can get pretty stressful, even for a toddler. And so an organization in Germany has launched the first ever resort for stressed out kids under the age of 5. According to the Daily Mail newspaper, the resort offers massages, foot baths, and walks through wet grass without shoes and socks. Though, David, there are no details yet on how they get 3-year-olds to sit still for massages for any length of time.
Well, that's a little sad about the need for that. I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
On APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.